I have no idea why the Joshless episodes are spooky intro music, but I'm happy with that, happy to have it.
I was going to say, it sounds like a Halloween episode at this point.
Yep. So as you may have heard, we have Justin from the Movie Wire here. And if Justin's here, that means Josh is not. Now, Justin, do you know where Josh is going?
I don't know. Last I heard, he was on vacation. I don't know. It's something. It's either sick or vacation, but I think this excuse is vacation. I think he's going overseas. I think Switzerland or something.
Yeah, let me see. I have my AirTag on him. Let's see if we can patch in and see what's going on with him.
Get to the chopper!
Oh, okay. All right.
Josh, you've matured.
Yeah.
Switzerland's really had an effect on him.
Yeah, it sounds a little spooky over there, too. Like, commanding a team? Are they going to, like, do some fist bumps? Maybe some, like, aggressive hand-holding while flexing?
I want to know if he's hanging out with Jamie Lee Curtis, too.
This week is a big week in that the legendary James Cameron children, for those of you who don't know, because he's only released two movies in the last, like, 28 years. He's the director of Avatar 1 and 2. No, not the Netflix one, not the M. Night Shyamalan one, the Blue People one. And he found some time in his busy schedule of one movie every 13 years to go back and give a nice 4K Ultra HD polish to two seminal films from my childhood. And I imagine yours as well, Justin.
These two are huge in my childhood, and I think, because I picked up both of these, I have a copy on digital, and I picked up the hard copies, too. And James Cameron with this one is what boggles the mind, but it makes sense to me, is you take a huge technical achievement like The Abyss, you have Avatar, but you have this really kind of innocent, simplistic story of true lies. And that's the one that really stands out with a lot of the numerous awards that it's gotten over the years. And it just, it's shocking to me, but it's honestly a good message to Hollywood when it comes to special effects and adding Arnold Schwarzenegger to your movie to actually finally get some awards.
Yep. So we are going to be talking about the 4K restoration of The Abyss and True Lies. But before we get to that, we have a promo from our friends over at I Hate It, Let's Watch It. Now, that does not apply because we both, I believe, love these films. But let's see what's going on over there with them.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lisa.
And I'm Dawn.
And if you've ever watched a TV show and thought to yourself, oh my God, that season finale plot twist was absolutely bonkers.
Or seen a movie and thought, wow, I need to talk to somebody about this train wreck immediately.
Then we think you'll fit right in with our podcast, I Hate It, Let's Watch It. We watch TV shows like Riverdale and Emily in Paris.
And movies like Deep Water, Killer Sofa, Rubber, and Deadly Illusions. And we give them the total rinsing they deserve.
It's basically group therapy for movie masochists. So come check us out wherever you stream podcasts.
All right, Justin, I want to talk to you first about The Abyss. Now, The Abyss has been called by some people a bit of a reckoning for James Cameron. He came from the Corman Film School, which is cheap movies as quickly as possible. You film it in a few weeks. And yet, like, Jack Nicholson came out of that school as an actor. And you have all these wild little independent films, and Cameron cut his teeth on it. He came out swinging with Piranha 2, The Spawning, which he officially will not recognize because rumor is he quit midway through directing that, something like that.
Oh, he was fired. Stop it.
Oh, yeah. But he did The Terminator, which The Terminator to me is kind of like Ex Machina. It wasn't a huge hit, but it was an establishing piece. It was, look what I did with this budget. Now, it did make a star out of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Then after that, he did Aliens, which basically created the template for what I can do with a big budget, but also a kind of template of what to do with a sequel. You pivot tone, you and you make it bombastic and you just do what you can with it. And after Aliens, he was riding high and he went, I want the abyss. I'm writing this. I'm doing this underwater kind of grungy feeling. We're focusing on, there's a military aspect, but we're focusing on the divers, the machinists, the oil, you know, the oil folks. And it came out and it was a bit of a reckoning, so much so that he then went, ran away and did Terminator 2 to get a little bit of that back. But the Abyss is unfairly maligned.
Yeah. And to kind of backtrack a little bit, I mean, James Cameron, one of the most dangerous things in Hollywood is to take a new director, have a hit or have a critically accepted movie, and then do another one, then do another one. This is more dangerous when it comes to a filmmaker than almost a loaded gun, because you grow that ego, you grow that overconfidence, you have these studios throwing money at you, and then you get to kind of the peak with your one of your biggest budgets with The Abyss, and then we get a production that we're probably going to talk about here pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And this is one that I think was a pivotal moment for Cameron, where he had to kind of check himself and kind of evolve as a filmmaker on how he does his productions, because the Abyss is legendary when it comes to not only what the cast says about it, but what his film historians talk about it. And to the point that even the main star, Ed Harris, refuses to revisit or talk about what happened on set. I think he was quoted at one point saying, asking me about my experience about the Abyss is like asking a veteran, how was Vietnam? So this, the Abyss is a very intriguing story when it comes to not just the movie, but the evolution of the filmmaker and what happens when you have a big head on your shoulders.
Oh, yeah. I kind of liken it to Spielberg's 1941. Spielberg had a few hits back to back. He had his little TV movie called, I believe, Drive or The Chase, something like that. Then he had Jaws, which was just a massive hit for him. Then he followed that very quickly up with Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And he was like, I am Hollywood. I am creating summer blockbuster. And then he did 1941, which is this spoof, but it's not really funny. It's kind of about like the infamous incident in LA during the actual World War II, where they started firing what they thought was like, we were being invaded briefly for like 20 minutes. They're firing at lights in the sky. No one quite knows what it is, but he's like, let's make a comedy about that. And it, he says it humbled him. Now, James Cameron would never say he was a humbled man, but he did pivot pretty quickly and say, let's do Terminator 2, baby. So The Abyss is a story, came out in 1989. It is about a nuclear sub that something, American nuclear sub, that something happens to it during the height of the Cold War. The sub ends up crashing and the military must commandeer a deep sea diving rig to go explore the submarine to see did the Russians did it. The movie mostly focuses on the tensions between the rig divers and the military. The military people are led by Michael Biehn, who some people might know as his name in Terminator, Mr. Connor, John Connor's father. He's also from Aliens because he is one of Cameron's kind of like special ones that he likes to pick up and just drop into a movie. The other side of this, you have, as you said, Ed Harris, who's playing Bud. He's the foreman. And then you have Mary Elizabeth Mastertino, who is Dr. Lindsay Brigham, the estranged wife of Bud, who is going down there because they're using her tech, her rigs, her subs, and she's kind of pissed off about it. That they're using this tech, not how she wanted it to. They're using these rigs. And the crux of the film becomes the Russians didn't do it. Something did it. But on top of that, they layer almost immediately what they call nitrogen madness, which is when you're that far down, you have to cycle the oxygen with something else. And some people can handle it and some people can't. And from the very first scene where they mention that, Michael Biehn's character, the head of the military group that's going down there, you see he's hiding a tremor in his hand. They don't layer that at all. They don't hide it from us. He's hiding it. But we know there are multiple ticking bombs that are just going around right now. One, we saw what kind of crashed the sub, but we don't know what it is. And then we know that tensions are just going to rise, much like the tensions on set.
Yeah, you can definitely see the tensions from the set go into the screen. But I'll say this up front. I hated Dr. Lindsay. I thought she was the element that she was obnoxious, annoying right when she comes on screen and lecturing the Navy SEALs. I enjoyed the blandness of the Navy SEALs more than I enjoyed Dr. Lindsay in this movie. But you're absolutely right, because there are so many, and there's, to me, there is no question that Cameron knows how, in a secluded environment, knows how to build tension. He knows how to add elements and work the camera to really invite the audience to really take part of what could potentially happen. So I think he does a good job with that. Now, is the payoff of all these elements, does it really pay off in the end? That's up for an opinion. But to me, I think some work, some don't.
Yep.
But what I do appreciate about it is the build. This movie is completely about build. And what at the remastered at 2 hours and I think 20 minutes, we really get engulfed into this environment and we get a lot of these close shots with these cast members. So I think there is a lot of great stuff here when it comes to creating the environment that Cameron does. But, and I think as evil as I'm going to say this is, I think Cameron's strategy of being the dictator on set and creating that tension on set, we saw that on screen. And whether or not if we had a different director at the helm of this, I don't know if we would get that same kind of effect that we see on screen. I think he should have fired Dr. Lindsay, but you know, but I think everybody else does a fantastic job.
All right. So to talk about the production briefly, because it's going to be important for two scenes that I want to talk about. Cameron had all the money in the world to work on. The majority of this action happens on the rig, which is underwater, and the two little submersibles. Now, a director in theory would go, cool, we build a set for everything and we do some green screening for the water. Maybe we do the old Hollywood thing where anytime there's a window, it's filled with water because we literally just have water in it. No, they went to a decommissioned nuclear silo, a nuclear power plant. They built the rig to watertight. They sank the rig. And to get to acting, you had to go down in a submersible, get into this environment. They were filming. That set was real. They were filming on that set underwater, something like 60, 70 feet down, because it was in the cooling pools. And to get offset, you had to actually go through decompression because you're just far down enough and they're doing the pressurized air. So if you are getting pissed off because you're being forced to do take after take after take, you can't leave. You're on a set and you have to storm over to the little pressurized thing to get into the little submersible to then decompressurize and come up. And if you do that, you have to stay out for a certain amount of time and then come back. So he would keep them down there for like 15, 16 hours straight to just film this movie. And the pool was real, the whole little pressurized pool thingy that you see. That's one of the main sets where the submersibles are, where they sink in to get out of the rig. And to jump ahead a little bit, because the story is fairly simplistic. There's something out there. You find out, you're not sure if it's biological or not. And the end of the second act is the big blow up between the military and the rig. This happens because the military is, we have to recollect our nuclear secrets. And if there is a threat, we are dealing with it with those nukes. The tension boils to a point because there's a hurricane happening on the surface. The boat that they're attached to gets kind of separated. All this comes crashing down, which is a beautiful scene. The tension of that scene is amazing. And then they do have confirmation that something else is there and we're going to attack it. Now, before we get to the big part that is the most amazing scene to me and the most offensive, they have what is perhaps the best bump the lamp moment when all the crew sees the intelligence that's in the water, and you see this water tendril form and start going through the ship. And Dr. Lindsay interacts with it. And so you're looking at something that's not there. You know that's not there because that's a visual effect, this water tendril that starts mimicking their faces, looking at them. It's a beautiful scene. And Alan Silvestri, that score and those gentle score in that moment. And then she bumps the lamp by reaching out her finger, pulling it into the water's face, which is a visual effect, and then pulling it back, and water is dripping from her finger, and she licks it and says, "Salt water." That is just gorgeous moment. That is just precision filmmaking of knowing how far you can push your tech because you want that reveal, that moment.
The birth of CGI here and how much you can push your tech. Now, it's not a matter of what you can do. I think it was a matter of this shit's expensive, of running out a nuclear power plant and having our actors down for 15, 16 hours. There's got to be a better way. So halfway through the movie, they finally figured it out by just having a blob of water in the sub. So congratulations, LucasArts and Industrial Light. So you just saved the future of people being submerged. So it's an incredible scene. This is the wow factor. And again, we'll see this wow factor going into the 89 on to the 90s with the T-Rex being in Jurassic Park being that wow factor. So a lot of these special effects, you have that pivotal moment where it's just jaw-dropping. Oh, yeah. And this is what I appreciated about, we talk about the build. That first scene where we get a glimpse of it, where we have the light reflection off of one of the diving suits, where we kind of get the moment of a tease of what's kind of down there, that something else is down there. And then it goes into a panic mode. The brilliance of these types of movies is they don't show and tell right away. So they just give just brief hints. And we saw that with Spielberg's Jaws, right? Mm-hmm. It's the most brilliant strategic movies are the ones that show very little and rely on the technical aspects of performances and the storytelling to really have the audience guess. Like you said brilliantly earlier, the ticking time bomb element. Now, we talk about the simplistic story. This isn't the original idea when it comes to the seclusion aspect in 89. I mean, we had Deep Star 6, we had The Evil Below, Lords of the Deep. All these came out in 89. So, and this one had to compete against a lot of these secluded underwater movies. And I think this movie could have done a little bit more if we done a little bit better at the box office, if we didn't have a lot of these almost tiresome movies come out where people have seen it before, because this is where it gets a little tricky when it comes to the seclusion aspect of it. Water is for a lot of people a fear, the being underwater, the drowning aspect of it. These are triggers of fear that Cameron really taps into. And what I really liked about the design of the CGI water is it's like almost a ray of hope where it makes the audience relax because it's not this alien creature we're seeing. It's not this grotesque creature that we saw from those other movies. It's almost just a beautiful sight to kind of have us take a breath and then just enjoy the scenery as we see from the annoying Dr. Lindsay when she first sees it. So it really does kind of relax it. And they could have gone in a completely wrong direction and just had a really monster kind of design, but that's not the story that they wanted to tell. They wanted this creature to be the opposite of the seclusion fear. They wanted this creature to be the opposite of the tense fear. The real horror in this movie is the unknown elements and the characters, not the creature that we'll see fast forwarding in the movie towards the end. So I think they did a brilliant job on really not going the wrong direction, but really focusing on the characters and the elements to really drive that fear in this film.
Oh, you're more than right about all of that. Because right after we get our little ray of hope of watching this thing move around, it begins to explore the rig more. And it finds the nuclear device that the Marines have. And what immediately happens? The Marines hit the door shut that clips it, and the water just splashes. It literally just kills it. And in that moment, the film accelerates to its second act, or the end of the second act, which is the Marines are like, there's something, we've now have confirmation. We don't know what it is, but it must be intelligent. And so they're taking a nuke. They're going to steal one of the subs, and they're going to go into this trench, the abyss. Whatever's down there, they're taking it out. this is part when you're watching the restoration. The effects are not that great because you can have, I mean, they're inside these little submersibles. They're battling each other by basically bumping each other as hard as they can into things. You can see the model work against the background's not quite all there. And then you can see the where they insert shots of the people inside the rig. And it's like, okay, you're just layering cells on top of each other. It's not quite working. It still looks good in the tension in that music in the moment. And so they ended up crashing each other. The Marine with his nuke ends up plummeting. Goodbye, Michael Biehn. And this scene, I have always forgotten how long it is. But you have Ed Harris and Mary Masterson. You have them together in the sub. There is one suit. And she comes up with the plan of, you are the stronger swimmer. You put... the water is freezing. I will go into like this hypothermic state where I am almost dead, but not quite dead. You swim back with me. You bring my body back and you guys can revive me. I won't be dead. I'll just be really, really close to it. And he stays, the James Cameron, in that sinking submersible, filling with that cold water under in that cooling tower, stays on them as I swear she probably, as an actress, realize, oh my god, he's going to drown me, because that water rises in that sub. Ed Harris has the suit on, the tank working, and the water gets higher and higher, and she's gasping for air as the camera's just right at her temples. Then it fills up, she's under, and Ed Harris has to watch her drown in front of him. Oh,
that scene, I think, out of any scene, you feel, as a viewer, you feel the coldness, you feel mm-hmm. just the anticipation, you know kind of what's going to happen, but you just, this is like a scene where I would cover my eyes versus watching just pure gore, because mm-hmm. The tension is so real, the tension is so targeted towards what I fear, because me, I have a huge fear of drowning, I have a fear of water. And that is one of the horror elements that I just can't stand to mm-mm. witness, is to watching human life just kind of disappear right there under suffocation. And you add that with the seclusion element, you're hoping and you're rooting that things work out, but they open up that wide angle shot of how big this environment and how big this distance is. And you're like, there is no way. And it's a good example when we go back to look at how difficult this, again, this production would have been. Because, yeah, there is some risk that we look back now. I think we tend to look at special effects and practical effects and say, how did they do that? And we come back at the abyss and we're more like, how did the cast members do that? How did these performances really get a reaction out of it? And I know we had Ed Harris that almost drowned on set, James Cameron mm-hmm. that almost drowned on set. So these reactions are even more important when we go back as a rewatch to really look and focus on just the different reactions our cast has. Because in some of these scenes, these are actual real cast members fearing for their life.
Oh, yeah. So he then has to swim back with her body to the moon pool, and they lay her there. And I didn't realize until this rewatch, the resuscitation scene is about 5.5 minutes long. It is brutal. He brings her up there. He lays her. The makeup effects, whatever they did to just suck the life out of her, I don't know if they just kept her in cold water for a while. So the rigger crews around them, as well as like the one good Marine, and he's giving her CPR, they're shocking her, he's breaking, Ed Harris is breaking down, calling her Liz, asking her to come back, telling her to breathe, he's smacking her face, he's like telling her to fight, because she's always been like, I think he even says like, you've always been such a bitch, don't give up on me now, or something like that. He's like insulting her, smacking her, they're just shocking her, everyone gives up, and that's the moment where everyone's just stops, and they're like, you gotta let her go, and you wait, and you're like, okay, so she died, okay. And then he goes back to breathing in her mouth, yelling at her. And she finally does this weak thing and he brings her back. And it is 5.5 minutes of anguish, Like, I don't know another director who would just sit there and toy with your emotions that long over, is she coming back or not? Because we've seen this in the Marvel movies. We've seen this in other movies where it's like, oh, they're expected to be dead. Okay, you know, let her go. She's gone. And one more chest compression. Oh, you know. No, this is like 55 more compressions. This is like three more shocks. And it is a brutal scene. And then you realize that when Mary Master, when the actor talks about that scene is, oh, yeah, she's laying there in cold water. Her shirt's torn open, so she's vulnerable and partially nude. And the camera's on her face as Ed Harris is slapping the crap out of her to try to bring life back in her. And she can't react. She has to be cold, numb, nude, still. And it was something like after like the second or third take, she apparently stood up, just screamed at James Cameron, said something like, we're not animals. You can't do this to us. And like walked off. And so they cobbled together the footage for what they had for that scene, which works amazingly. But that also kind of tells you, was she expecting three or four more takes? Was she expecting this? Like, okay, well, we're going to get more coverage of you being hit, you know? And it is just an emotionally gut-wrenching moment, especially when you realize that's not a prop body. That's an actress in the cold, vulnerable, with someone screaming in her face to live, to breathe. And Ed Harris has given his all, and she just has to absorb it. And that is just shocking. And as a viewer, my emotions seeing that scene for the first time in probably 10, 15 years, because I'd seen it on TV. They edit around all that. They cut it for time. But the director's intention to just linger on grief and pain, it hurt me.
So kind of what you're saying is Underwater Fight Club. Got it. Right. So, but here's the beauty of that scene is it really amplifies what this movie's about. It's about hope. It's about faith. It's about just the human nature of it. So when he goes and comes back, that is exactly what we were talking about when it comes to that symbol or alien being of being hope. He has an instinct and he has a faith of coming back to try one more time. So this movie is almost a balance between the human animalistic behaviors of humans. When we have the nuclear sub, we have that kind of hinting at it. We have these out of our elements kind of like drowning in death. All these elements come back to really test our human ability to really give and exercise our hope of survival. So I think it's a very brutal scene. And again, it's one of those that's hard to watch on two different elements. One, how real it looks, and two, the fear if it's going to work. So There's a lot going on this scene that it's, again, really hard to watch. Not as almost as much as the drowning scene, but you're really rooting that something's going to happen. And I think it's a brilliant move to really have that pause, to really come back, try one more time, because that's going to really prove that point of hope and faith that Our aliens are really there to symbolize. So it's a great scene, but again, we go back to, it almost makes you kind of scratch your head on how and what's going through this cast's head when this is happening. This is kind of one of my big examples of productions that really kind of changed the course of Hollywood and how directors do things. But at the same time, the direction worked.
Oh, it did. So I don't want to spoil the ending. I mean, there are aliens, but I had never seen the director's cut of this film. I'm not a huge fan of director's cut because growing up in the shift from VHS to DVD to Blu-ray, there was 5,000 director's cuts that add about a minute and a half, and it's normally some untasteful nudity, which appreciated, or oh my gosh, instead of one F-bomb for PG-13, they had three in there, and so it's unrated. And then you have something like Kingdom of Heaven, which is Ridley Scott. The director's cut is the cut to watch. But then you also have Alexander, which there's been like 75 director's cut of that. You have situations where Donnie Darko, which the director's cut kind of takes away. I mean, it gives, but it more takes away than gives. There's also the director's cut of Blade Runner, which the less said about that, the better, in my opinion. But what happened was, even though Cameron was at the peak of his powers, he signed a deal that you can deliver whatever movie you want as long as it's under 230. Well, his first cut was about 3 hours. So he went there and, having cut his teeth as an editor and production designer, he chopped it down to a brisk 220. And dear God, the director's cut actually makes this film. Have you seen it?
I have, yeah. Okay. So, and I think this is where it really does kind of take its time. And there's some really good stuff here. I think, honestly, it's good. I think the 220 mark is kind of where this movie needs to kind of stay. But out of respect, I think there is some good elements to it. But when it comes to the pacing piece of it, I think the 220 kind of runtime really moves this right along to give us just enough to really build that tension and really prove the themes of the movie. So either one that you watch, I think this one is kind of the good meat in the middle.
The reason why the director's cut changed my mind is because you do get more beats between the estranged married couple, and I enjoy that. But the normal cut that people see, the theatrical one, the ending just kind of happens. There's no real explanation. There's no real story element of like why the alien beings are down there, or what happened with the crash or something like that. It just kind of lets it, we discovered this stuff and now is the time. But then when you see the director's cut and why they're down there, what is happening, you do get this a foreshadowing of what Cameron eventually would make the Avatar films about. Environmentalism, people suck, stop strip mining the planet, please stop whaling things. And I do think it adds more context that makes it less ambivalent, but I will probably just watch the theatrical cut when I need to watch this film. And this may be controversial, but honestly, I think The Abyss is probably his best film, hands down.
We might get in a disagreement on that one, but the theatrical one, that's commercial. That is them catering to audiences. Like I said, it's going up against all other movies that have the kind of same underwater premise to it, if you will. So this one was to appease audiences, and you can tell that this one was just on the editing table. They wanted between an hour and a half to 2 hours. They wanted this pacing. They wanted that blockbuster. They wanted, if we're spending $70 million on this movie, this has to be a hit, and it has to gain the attention of the audience, and it has to be better than all these other underwater movies that are coming out this year. So this one was to capture attention. The theatrical was there to capture attention span, not add a lot of depth that we saw from the director's cut to even this.
I agree. Yeah, I agree with that. Go watch this film. Buy it on physical media, because you can't get the director's cut anywhere on streaming right now. I believe Hulu has it, the 4K restoration, the theatrical cut. It's well worth watching. It looks gorgeous. The sound design is amazing. Alan Silvestri, his score is damn near perfection.
We didn't talk about that, and that was one of the magical elements of this movie, but I would agree, because the audio, if you have Atmos speakers, this is the best thing you can listen to at home.
It is really one of his unsung soundtracks. Cameron hired Silvestri and got away from his bread and butter, which was Brad Fidel. He had done Cameron's films and actually would return to Cameron's films with Terminator 2 and True Lies. So it was very obvious Cameron wanted something different from this film, his passion project. By the way, little factoid, that underwater rig is actually still available. People occasionally rent it out for doing other things.
Since you said something controversial, I'm going to say something controversial. To me, I think the composer here, I think, you know, he's done a lot of projects, Avengers Endgame, whatever, and Abyss. And even though I'm a big fan of his musical score of The Abyss, it will never compete to two films. Can you guess those films, Alex?
Of Silvestri's score?
Yep.
I don't know.
I'm going to blow your mind right now. You ready for it?
Oh, well, Back to the Future.
Way no? off. Nope. Way better.
Overboard?
No. God, no.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
It's close, but no.
I won't get it. What is it?
tied for two movies, Cop and a Half and Super Mario Brothers.
Huh. Okay, yeah. One, my mind's blown. And two, oh my God, that's right. The Super Mario Brothers soundtrack is actually really good.
And that's I can't hold a straight face on this one. I'm taking back Cop and a Half. That was fucking awful.
I guess he's going to be Father of the Bride.
Ooh, that's a great score, too. Very memorable score.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see your face. It was classic. Well worth it.
So Cameron, after earning back his good credit with Terminator 2, went with True Lies. Now, this was during a flux in his filmography, because he was working on a few different projects, and out of nowhere, Arnold Schwarzenegger came up to him and said, I want you to rewrite this French film I've seen, and let's shoot it. And James Cameron went, what the hell? I'm not a rewriter. Like, I'm not a remake artist. And Arnold said, I want to try acting for once. So Cameron goes home, watches this damn film. He didn't change a whole lot. The plot is the same thing. The plot is husband is secretly a spy, been married for a few years. Wife doesn't know anything about it. Finds out about it. They kind of team up. Now, you would think that that premise has been done 1,000 times. And it has been done 1,000 times. But somehow they get an amazing performance out of Tom Arnold. A sleazeball performance out of Bill Paxton, one of Charlton Heston's last roles. And just get it out of the way. It looks good. Okay. They did some cleanup. It looks good. All right. Less said about that, the better, because it looks great. Watch it in 4K. It's a way to watch it. But how the hell, if you look at Arnold has the same problem The Rock has. Their bodies are too weird. I'm not body shaming. I'm just saying their build, their physique, the way they present and carry themselves are so bizarre that when you put somebody beside them as a romantic interest, nothing really happens. You look at The Rock with Emily Blunt. You look at The Rock in any of his movies. He doesn't really hug or kiss the girl, even though he's with the girl. Arnold, they threw Sharon Stone at him. They threw a bunch of people at him to try to make things work. Even Conan the Barbarian, where they literally throw a woman to him to kind of grope. It doesn't work. But somehow you put Jamie Lee Curtis with Arnold, and God damn, they have chemistry. This movie has so many weird pivots to it. It's like 4 or 5 movies all happening at once, and it changes from scene to scene. And you say something, because I don't even know.
The movie is all about chemistry, because this is a very simplistic fantasy. And when you take the first act where we're introduced to Schwarzenegger and Curtis, and Schwarzenegger is what, a IT guy, for which there's no way anybody would buy this. I mean, like an IT guy for Pornhub. So this, between Schwarzenegger and Curtis, the chemistry is there when they actually get going and they start interacting. But when we first see him on screen, it literally looks so odd, especially being introduced to Schwarzenegger's spy character in the opening scene where he's at the party, he's doing the tango. And then we put him in the home setting that is complete opposite. And we don't know right away. I remember my first viewing on this. I wasn't sure if I was going to buy into this. But this movie wins because of the cast. It wins because the cast all work in unison with the chemistry. You can tell this is a polar opposite to the production of The Abyss, because we see the cast having fun with their roles. And, yeah, you know, and we're going to talk about it, but, you know, there's a level of comfort when you see Jamie Lee Curtis just stripping in front of Schwarzenegger. So yes, you can tell there's a little bit of comfort there. And Jamie Lee Curtis obviously was nervous, but it was so utilized to perfection in that one scene. And I'm not saying that as a teenage boy really hitting rewind over and over and over again, or as an adult, but the chemistry is just fantastic. And like I said earlier, I'm like, this is one of those Cameron movies that you would have never expected to be one of his most accepted, to an arguably with the exception of T2 Aliens, but this is the one that really did win a ton of awards, not necessarily Oscars, but a lot of awards in the background, especially Jamie Lee Curtis, which I think this one was her second most awarded movie that she's been in.
You're right. It starts off with there's this kind of very James Bonding action flick. You expect it from Arnold. He has some quippy one-liners. They do kind of this little heist thing. He blows something up. There's a snowmobile ski chase that happens and stuff. And then you get introduced to his domestic life, and you very quickly find out his domestic life is not what it should be, which is expected. His daughter is like dating this guy who's older than her, who is driving a motorcycle. She's pilfering cash from him. Jamie Lee Curtis is kind of, you know, is the put upon wife. Like, oh, honey, that back foundation piece, they need to dig some stuff out. It's going to cost like $1,500. And he goes, okay, pay it. And she's like, no, that's robbery. It should be only be this much. And he's like, okay. And then she quips again some other time, like, oh, I had the plumber come over to fix the thing. Well, how much did it cost? Well, I slept with him, so he cut off $100. And Arnold just kisses her and says, good thinking. You know? She's trying to get a rise out of him, trying to pull from him, because she truly believes he is this IT guy who's working things. She's going to conferences. He is the breadwinner. But you find out that when Arnold does finally try to make a moment for her, just take her to lunch, she's out with somebody. And Tom Arnold has that beautiful line, which he's like, oh, thank God she's just cheating on you. Welcome to the club, man. I'm on my third wife, or something like that, you know? And it pivots to her story for about a good 25, 30 minutes. Arnold is now trying to figure out, like, what is going on with my life? How do I use my spy tech to completely fuck everything up in my life? Illegally doing shit. When it becomes her movie for that second act, this movie changes tone so quickly and so beautifully. You find out that she's, in theory, cheating with Bill Paxton, who she thinks is actually a spy. And he's pulling her in, like, doing dangerous liaisons kind of thing. Well, Arnold finds out he's actually just kind of a scummy used car salesman with one of the most horrible lines to think about in the world. But it is so memorable that he his quip. You know the line, right?
No, remind me.
Bill Paxton, he's talking about Jamie Lee Curtis and how hot she is. And an ass like a 10-year-old boy.
Oh, yes. Good Lord. Bill Paxton, this is his sleaziest role, but I love the fact that Paxton and Schwarzenegger are the same but opposites. Paxton is pretending to be a spy, and Schwarzenegger is pretending to be the domestic husband. But this is what I like, and you touched on it, which is great, is when Curtis is by herself, it's almost like a completely different movie. It feels like it could have run. She could have led this movie by herself. And again, it's entertaining to watch. And by the way, the cost of the repair was $600, not $1,500, Alex, just so you know.
My apologies. Thank you.
Yep. And he was ignoring her because he's going back to his IT porn video. So between the two elements where we actually see him really go into the work to really try and be involved with his wife, that's a great scene. That's a great element to show the human nature of it. The only flaws I would say is that's something we need a little bit more of. I think we need a little bit more build on it. I think they do an okay giving us little cherry pick snippets to kind of show us what they are. But I think the family element, given the runtime, could have been a little bit more. So it doesn't feel like a Schwarzenegger movie, just with a higher big budget. Because I think what really drove it for me is when we get kind of towards the end with the daughter being taken, it reminded me, even though it came out, of the Face-Off climax. Yes. Where the daughter gets kidnapped, and that had some chemistry, that build to it, where we get to know the character. When we're banking on this daughter without using, it's your daughter, the obvious, it's your daughter, you have to save her. This is where the stakes kind of lacked a little bit, because we only really see her briefly kind of in the movie, and there's really no stakes to really root for it other than Schwarzenegger stealing a jet and trying to save her. Then it goes into a Schwarzenegger movie. So I think there are some flaws to this, but at the same time, what really does make this movie so, so special, one, you'll never hear me say this, is the bigger budget with the, it looks great, bigger budget and the performances and the chemistry. I think this one, I would have loved to see an extended cut if they added a lot of these elements.
No, I agree with that, because when it gets to the climax, it does just kind of veer off into, we're back to Schwarzenegger. He's shooting people up. She assists. There's a great kind of, it would now be considered very rote. Of course, if you have a wife and you have like a seductress, they're the ones who have to fight each other. It has to happen. Mind you, it does happen in a speeding car and is fantastic. Jamie Lee Curtis gets an amazing moment when there's a quip that, you know, Harry has died, that she smacks the crap out of him. And I love it. I love that she spins her wedding ring to the inside. So when she hits her, she cuts her. Beautifully thought of, perfectly done. But it does go, okay, we have to have the jet, we have to have the fight scene, I have to save my daughter. My daughter goes, Dad, you know. But I think a lot of that can be forgiven. And this is something that I've now noticed about Cameron, is that he likes emotional moments that ground the entire story. So in The Abyss, we've talked about it, 5.5 minute resuscitation scene. To talk about Titanic, you have that scene with Rose and her mother, where her mother dismisses, where Rose has been kind of caught sneaking off of Jack. Her mother dismisses the servant, gets behind her and starts lacing her up. And I love that she's lacing her up, because that is the physical embodiment of the metaphorical weight and emotional weight on her of being bound into the society of her. And her mother's just tightening those laces. And what she's telling her is like, do you not know what this could do? Do you not? We only have our good name left. Do you know what happens if this marriage falls through? That they're going to put our stuff to auction? Our belongings will be scattered to the wind? Do you want me to work my fingers to the bone as a seamstress? And she spins Rose around and takes her face. And you realize that, yeah, her mother's literally binding her into that society and that guilt in that moment. In this scene, it with True Lies, which is really Jamie Lee Curtis's movies for the emotional depth, is Harry and Tom Arnold have done some horrible shit to capture her in the moment where it looks like she was starting to get things on with Bill Paxton. But they put her in a chair in an interrogation room, and they interrogate her from the other side using voice modulators. And oh my, she won the Oscar, as should have, for Everything Everywhere All at Once. I think she really deserved it for this scene. Because they are interrogating her about, like, what are you doing? You're cheating on your husband. Do you know what's going on? Blah, blah, blah. And she gives this heart-wrenching performance of speaking from a mother's side, a housewife's side, of she wanted to feel alive again. She wanted something that just for a moment that she can just declare, that was me. I did this. I did something wild and unexpected. And that scene, every time it gets to it, to me, that is the crux of this film. Yeah, Arnold wanted to do this film so he could act, and he does. But Jamie owns this movie for that middle portion right there.
100%, because this is an Arnold movie, but realistically, this is primary Jamie Lee Curtis movie, because this is, like I said, she was recognized numerous times at different award ceremonies for this role, and well-deserved, because what I really hate is, just because it's big budget, just because things go boom, it's a Schwarzenegger movie, means you're disqualified. This is one of those movies that critics saw past that. They saw the performance. They saw the fantastic, complex character that she has. And she does, even though the dialogue's simplistic, it's supposed to be simplistic. She's a housewife. These are real people. So, I mean, she portrays that extremely well. But when it comes to kind of True Lies as a Cameron film, and this one I know I'm going to get a lot of flack, and I know Geeky Dad's probably going to call me out on this one. But when it comes to James Cameron, who specializes in taking us to fantasies, taking us to the sci-fi aspect of it, this to me is one of his greatest pieces of fantasy. This one, even though you can look at it as an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, it goes well over the top of an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, and it embraces the Schwarzenegger stereotype. Yeah. You have the horse in an elevator. You have the horse on the rooftop. You have the big Harrier jet. You have all these elements that really go over the top. In the 90s, we had this movie that I dearly love. It's a guilty pleasure, If Looks Can Kill.
Yes.
That was a movie fantasy for teenagers. This is a fantasy for middle-aged men and mm-hmm. those teenagers that want to be entertained by it. So when it comes to – and the reason that is because these are real people that really have real problems that we see in the house setting, but we're taking out Schwarzenegger as that symbol of yeah. what we want to be. You can't tell me no guy out there has – daydreamed about being a secret agent. We've all been there, but we're not built like Schwarzenegger. Well, no. Alex, you are. I'll take it back. I'm just talking about myself. But this is a great fantasy. It's yeah. a great popcorn movie to take it out. And I don't want to say it's the best James Cameron movie, but I will say when it comes to relatability, this is his best relatable fantasy for audiences.
You're 100% correct. And to bring to that point, that fantasy is that, yeah, you're middle, you know, they're middle aged. They're supposed to be in their late 30s, early 40s. They have a daughter who is about 13, which I always forget that this is one of Elijah Dushku's first films. She's their daughter. She would eventually go on to be Faith in the Buffy. But to bring it back to the fantasy aspect is that he gives Helen a task, which is to, you know, just go spy and do this, you know, be the seductress. The guy doesn't like, don't worry, you don't have to sleep with him. He just likes to, you know, watch you strip. And yeah, so he sets this all up. So he's in the room. He has a little voice of, you know, playback of his friend who's works in the works in the office, who's French. And he's like playing this tape while he's in shadow of like, and he watches his wife walk in. And he's like, okay, he's okay. And then she starts to strip and dance. And Jamie Lee Curtis, as you said, teenage boy and an adult man, Jamie Lee Curtis is a very attractive woman.
100%.
And she's doing these movements, and to seduce him, everybody knows about it, but I'll just say it for the one person who doesn't. When she's dancing and she's like grabbing the bedpost, she slips and she falls. That was not planned. That happened. She immediately pops back up and starts dancing again. And you look in the background and you can see that Arnold at that moment starts to stand up like, oh shit, she fell, and then sits back down. That as well was not planned, but they kept it rolling. They just went with it, and it works. And it is that fantasy of like, you know, you've been in your marriage for a few years. Yes, there's still a spark, but then all of a sudden, it's like you're looking at your wife in a new perspective of like, oh, that's right, my wife is goddamn hot, man. She's willing to do this for like, you know, this random dude. We need to talk in the bedroom.
Well, even you talk about that, even when Schwarzenegger drops the tape recorder, that wasn't planned either.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can tell the nerves are here, but that's what makes this movie so special and relatable, is because we have these little mistakes, and Cameron was smart keeping these in, because if we just went without these two mistakes in this and the nervousness from Curtis, it would have been kind of a stiff strip show. I mean, there's some human nature to this that really kind of is not goofy, but just, it's almost sweet. It's cute, I want to say. And yeah. Sexy. And okay. Sexy.
And of course, what is, you know, the end of the fantasy is the wife and him are now living their life together. There's no more secrets. There's no more lies. She is getting her fulfillment of, we're venturing off together and we're doing these things as a couple. And he is getting his fulfillment of like, of realizing he doesn't have to lie anymore. And yeah, I should have been paying attention to her. And, you know, it's beautiful. It's for as bombastic as a film is, that the casting, the fantasy, it works. And it looks gorgeous in 4K.
It does. And the ending is the pure, like, neat bow on the movie, where it just ends like a romance novel. So it's cliche, it's cheesy, it's cringe, but oh, is it so good.
It is. Well, Justin, let's get out of here, sir. Why don't you tell me a little bit about your 67 podcasts you have going on?
It's only two. I can't even squeeze any more in. But you can check out my main show, The Movie Wire, anywhere you listen to podcasts. And you can follow me on my socials anywhere at Movie Wire Show. And you can also check out me and Antonio from the Cult Worthy Cinema podcast news show, Back to the Balcony. You can check that out on YouTube and, again, anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Well, you can catch Talking Smack at any podcaster of your choice. We would, of course, like to thank Leo Allen for our musical themes that are not currently playing because this is my spooky theme. Of course, we'd like to thank Beppo for original avatars, Richard Lair's studio for our Ricky avatar. You can email us at talkingsmackpod@gmail.com. You can join our Discord, which is the same thing. I won't ask you to pimp our Discord because, frankly, we're getting tired of everyone joining it. Stop. Please. Less people. No, please, more people. We need more people to yell at and tell us we have bad opinions. And of course, we'll see you next week, which I think we have Ghostbusters Afterlife. Holy crap, how long is this outro? That's enough of that.
I know. I couldn't hear what you were saying.
Oh, that's fine. I'm going to have to bounce that. Oh, crap. I should probably stop recording.